stand by. We're about to begin. Good day, and thank you for joining us on today's call. As a reminder, today's conference is being recorded, and by being on the call, you consent to being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Brad Woodhouse. Please go ahead.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. I know we got a lot of people, speakers on the call, a lot of reporters on the call, and that's quite impressive given what a late night it was. And I do want to get into our speakers very quickly, but I just got a few opening remarks. I mean, look, there's no I'm not going to sit here and try to sugarcoat what happened last night for Democrats. It was we always knew it was going to be a rough sailing on these particularly rocky political waters. This was a geography, a map that was probably the least favorable in 50 years. I mean, of the 24 states President Obama lost in 2012, 80% had a Senate race this year. And in fact, the president lost six of these states by 19% or more. So there was a significant tide, running against Democrats. I mean, the wind was certainly in our face. I think this, this does really follow what most people would consider historical trends. I mean, Reagan lost eight Senate seats in 1986. George W. Bush lost six Senate seats and 30 House seats in 2006. And it's deja vu all over again. But while Democrats are, we're licking our wounds some this morning, there is, a silver lining. Tens of thousands of Americans are getting a raise. We saw state referendums to boost minimum wage passed everywhere it was on the ballot, even in fire red states like Nebraska, South Dakota, and Arkansas, and it looks like Alaska will join them as well. And I think this point's been made by other, other neutral commentators and others that, Republicans scored major political victories last night, but I don't believe there's any mandate for what we believe their governing philosophy is. In fact, you'll hear in a few minutes from Tom Jensen with public policy polling on some work that we did going into the election, both in the 2014 states and in the 2016 battleground states, that really says that the terrain is going to be potentially quite treacherous for Republicans, depending on how they decide, to govern going forward. In fact, Democratic issues, progressive issues, continue to animate where the American people are, whether it's on the minimum wage or whether it's on refinancing old student loans and the like, or whether it's on equal pay for equal work. So there's a big question for Republicans looking going into the 2016 presidential campaign, looking at the Senate map that they have going into 2016, and where are people in states that Obama won? We had a bunch of states last night that Obama lost, but where are these people going to be in the Senate in states that Obama won? Where's Rob Portman going to be on these critical issues? Where is Toomey going to be? Where is Mark Kirk? Where are others going to be? So, look, there's no doubt. Last night was tough in the political sphere, in the races, and certainly the political landscape that we went into going into the 2014 election. Was quite treacherous, but I think going into this next, and we're in a perpetual campaign now, and that's maybe some people see that as unfortunate, but it is in fact true, and we're going into a 2016 campaign cycle where the issues and the terrain, the geography favors Democrats, but really this call is about ideas and about policies. And look, if Republicans want to navigate this treacherous terrain in 2016, they'll take a look at these issues, and they'll work with Democrats to address them. I don't think there's any indication with people that were emboldened last night, like Ted Cruz and the Tea Party in the House, that is likely to happen. And therefore, I think what the silver lining for Democrats is that the issue terrain and the future political terrain going forward with this election now in the rearview mirror is something that that Democrats can take some solace in. So with that, let me turn the call over to somebody who really deserves a tremendous amount of credit for what we were able to do last night, particularly on the minimum wage, and who's been fighting for workers, fighting for wages, and is going to be in that fight for a good long time to come, and that is Mary Kay Henry, the International President of the Service Employees International Union, SEIU. Mary Kay?
Thank you, Brad. Good morning. I want to thank you all for joining us on the call today. As Brad has acknowledged, we had a tough night last night with so many close races, but this morning working people are getting out of bed and going to work and trying to figure out how to make ends meet and provide for their families. And we believe that for families all across this country, a key takeaway from last night is the progress that we made on the issue of raising wages for working families so that we can have an economy that works for all of us, not just the wealthy few. And raising the minimum wage was a winning issue yesterday in red states, blue states, and purple states. In deeply conservative states like Nebraska and South Dakota, the economy isn't working for regular people in any of these places. And the message from folks last night was that we have to increase wages and make it possible to work one job and create a decent life for our families. In San Francisco, where workers are going to get to $15 an hour, a year ahead of Seattle, we saw incredible momentum built from the Fight for 15, where fast food workers and home care workers have had the courage to come out and ask for wages that they can raise a family without having to cobble together two and three jobs and live on the brink. Working family issues also prevailed in Oakland with an increase in the wage to $12.25 an hour and earned sick time, which also passed in Massachusetts. The minimum wage results and wins in governor's races in Pennsylvania, Minnesota, and Connecticut show that working families want action on higher wages and good jobs that we can raise our families on. I spent yesterday in Pennsylvania, where everyone I met was incredibly excited to get out and volunteer and go vote for Tom Wolf. He's made crystal clear from the very beginning the issues at stake for working families on wages, health care, and education. We need more champions like Tom Wolf, Mark Dayton, and Dan Malloy. They won because working people gave them support on the ground and because they led and ran hard on higher wages, good schools, and affordable health care. Full-throated champions on those issues can and will win. The momentum behind the Fight for $15 an hour continued even on a tough night last night, like last night, because of the fearlessness of workers in fast food, home care, and at Walmart. They had the courage to stand up for a living wage and create momentum all across this country and made it possible for voters to endorse ballot initiatives that show that if you work hard for a living, you ought to be able to work one job and be paid enough to create a decent life and provide for your family. Working people will keep fighting for higher wages at the ballot box, in our workplaces, in our communities, and in the streets. The wins in Pennsylvania, Minnesota, Connecticut, and in the minimum wage ballot initiative show there is a path forward for working families in this country. Thank you, Brad.
Great, thank you. And with that, let me turn the call over to Tom Jensen. He's the Director of Public Policy Polling. Tom?
Thanks, Brad. We conducted two surveys Monday and Tuesday looking at some of these key issues that we've been talking about. One of the surveys was in the states that comprised the 2014 Senate battleground, which was obviously pretty conservative-leaning, states that, for the most part, Mitt Romney and John McCain won. Then we also looked at the same issues in what's likely to be the 2016 battleground, which is much friendlier terrain for Democrats. And just to start out by talking some about what we saw in the 2014 battleground, even though these are conservative states, even though the Republicans won in these states yesterday, among the people who voted, 76-17 support for passing the Paycheck Fairness Act, 73-16 support for allowing people to refinance old student loans, 52-44 support for increasing the minimum wage to $10.10 per hour. And what's particularly noteworthy about these numbers is that we also broke them out just among people who voted Republican for the Senate yesterday, and even just among people who voted Republican for the Senate, 61 to 29 support for the Paycheck Fairness Act, 61 to 27 support for allowing the refinancing of old student loans, 79 to 12 opposition to any cuts to Social Security and Medicare. So even though the Republicans won in these states, and even though these voters we're talking about are Republicans, we still are seeing this this desire for Congress to act on a lot of these sort of key economic issues that we've been talking about. And what really shows how important it is for the Republicans now that they're in charge of Congress to act on some of these things if they want to continue to do well at the ballot box is what we found among this 2016 electorate. When we look at the key battleground states in 2016, 78 to 9 support for allowing the refinancing of old student loans, 76 to 14 support for the Paycheck Fairness Act, 60 to 35 support for increasing the minimum wage to $10.10 per hour. And what we find in the 2016 battleground states is that voters trust Democrats a lot more than they trust Republicans on each of these issues. When it comes to equal pay for men and women, voters trust Democrats more than Republicans on that issue by 19 points, 54 to 35. On the minimum wage, voters trust Democrats more by 17 points, 54 to 37. On preventing cuts to Social Security and Medicare, Democrats are trusted more, 53 to 36. And on student loans, Democrats are trusted more than the Republicans, 51 to 34. So it's a situation where even if the Republicans won in these conservative states last night, they're still living dangerously if they fail to address these issues over the next couple years, when they're going to have to stand back before an electorate that's considerably more friendly to Democrats than the key places that voted last night. And this is really particularly an issue for Republicans as we look towards the 2016 presidential race. The Republicans are going to lose the presidential race again with a standard presidential year electorate if they continue to appear to be so conservative on some of these key issues. Voters say that if a presidential candidate opposes legislation to ensure equal pay for equal work, that makes them less likely to vote for that person by 34 points. If they oppose raising the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour, that makes voters less likely to vote for them by 18 points. And if you're a Republican, you really don't want to embrace anything that might involve making cuts to Social Security or Medicare. Voters say that they're less likely to vote for someone who supports doing that by 70 points. So certainly it was a bad night for Democrats last night. But it's still, when we look at a lot of these key issues, there is broad public support. There is support from a lot of Republican voters. And these are issues that are going to be really, really good for Democrats in 2016 when they're dealing with a friendlier electorate and a friendlier battleground if Republicans in Congress continue to impede action on them. So the message Republicans should take from last night's victory is not that they don't need to address issues like the minimum wage and paycheck fairness and student loans. There's still a strong mandate for working on those. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Brad.
Thanks, Tom. With that, let me turn it over to Anna Chu. She's the Director of Middle Out Economics at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Anna?
Thank you so much, Brad. As a lot of our speakers have been saying, there's really no question that Democratic candidates struggled last night. However, what's also clear is that the progressive vision of the economy won. Where voters had the chance, they supported policies that would invest in and empower workers. For example, we've noted, for minimum wage, voters in 5 out of 5 states with a ballot initiative to raise the wage approved them. This would help about 1.7 million workers. And these ballot initiatives passed in typically red-leaning states such as Arkansas, Alaska, Nebraska, and South Dakota with an average of 26 points, or average margin of 26 points. And you'll note that in other key races, including Arkansas, Alaska, and Illinois, Republican candidates actually had to flip their positions to come out and endorse a higher minimum wage. We also saw victory on paid sick days. In Massachusetts, even as Massachusetts elected a Republican governor, 60% of voters approved a measure to allow employees to earn up to 40 hours of paid sick time per year. And so what's also clear is that the success of the progressive vision on the economy in the election that is more white, rural, and conservative than in 2016 spells troubles ahead for Republicans. While Republican candidates won because of structural advantages in participation patterns for the midterm elections, the 2016 election will feature a far different electorate. So what's clear to any prospective candidate is that they must have a plan that will rebuild the economy that works for everyone, not just a wealthy few.
Great. Thank you, Anna. And with that, let me turn it over to our last speaker, Arun Ivaturi. I'm sorry, Arun. Senior campaign strategist for the National Employment Law Project Action Fund. Arun?
Thanks, Brad. So I just want to fill in some of the details on the minimum wage initiatives in particular that that passed yesterday. As Anna mentioned, initiatives passed in five different states. Four of those states, these were binding initiatives to increase the minimum wage. Those were the conservative-leaning ones, South Dakota, Nebraska, Alaska, and Arkansas. Those initiatives will give more than 400,000 workers a raise. There was also a non-binding referendum in Illinois. If legislators follow through on the will of voters there, an additional 1.1 million workers will see their pay rise. You have to go all the way back to 1996 now to find a state ballot measure on raising the minimum wage that failed to pass. So this is quite a record of success for raising the minimum wage when it's put before voters. In addition to the state referenda, there were initiatives in Oakland and San Francisco, as Mary Kay mentioned. Those measures will impact an additional 200,000 workers. One of those measures, San Francisco's, as Mary Kay said, would raise that city's wage to $15 an hour. That proposal passed overwhelmingly and drew no significant opposition even from the business community. So all told, it's over 1.7 million workers who stand to benefit from the measures passed yesterday. And so we feel the big victory on election night in these jurisdictions certainly are working people who are struggling to make ends meet. Now, one quick point about the political impact here. Obviously, the presence of these initiatives did not boost the fortunes of Democrats in some of these states as much as anticipated. But I think it's important to note, as Anna did, that in three of these states, you had Republican candidates in the states embrace the minimum wage or at least run away from their initial opposition to raising the minimum wage, clearly because they saw the will of the voters and clearly because they saw that it's a political liability to take a position against a very popular issue. You also see in terms of exit polls that 2 in 5 voters saw the economy and what it means to them as a critical issue in terms of their what motivated them to vote in the 2014 election, and 2 in 3 voters believe that the economic rules of our country favor the wealthy. So these are very populist attitudes that voters hold in 2014, and as Tom's polling has illustrated, when you look at a 2016 electorate, these populist issues will be even more prevalent and more significant for the electorate that decides the next president and the next Congress.
Arun, thank you. With that, let me turn it over to the operator who will cue people up for questions. I know some of our panelists will only have for a few more minutes, so if we could try to keep the subject matter to the to what we've been discussing to the extent that we can, the poll and the points that Mary Kay and others have made on the economic issues, that would be great. Operator, can we start the process of cueing people up for questions?
Certainly. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute button is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, it is star 1 to ask a question, and we ask that you keep your question to subject. And we'll pause a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal. And we'll take our first question from Jim Pazangira with Los Angeles Times.
Hi, thanks. I'm wondering on the minimum wage, given the results last night, what do you think that impact will be on Republicans and the president's proposal to raise the federal minimum wage? Do you think that loosens them up, or will they just say, let's just leave it to the states? That seems to be working fine at this point.
I mean, Mary Kay, do you want to take that, or I can take that first? Or
go ahead, Brad.
So, from a political perspective, I think it, and I'm not speaking for the White House, obviously, I think it should I think the success of the minimum wage in these ballot initiatives, I think the fact that some Republicans had to masquerade as minimum wage supporters, at least at the state level, in these elections, and I think the polling, our polling, other polling on the minimum wage, it demonstrates that it, at least from a political perspective, it's an issue the president and Democrats in Washington should continue to pursue. And I look, I think you know, Mitch McConnell said there might be circumstances under which you know, he would consider raising the federal minimum wage. So let's, you know, let's see what those circumstances, you know, might be. He said we can't do it when the economy's bad. Well, the economy is improving. You know, I would suspect that you have a Senate and a House in particular that has become more conservative, more Tea Party, and is will be more antagonistic to the president. So I don't necessarily see movement on their end on the minimum wage, because I think the Tea Partiers, look, they don't want to compromise with this president on anything. You know, even popular initiatives that have some support, if not strong support, among their own constituents. So I don't see a move on their end politically, but I would think that the White House and Democrats would be buoyed by the results in the states and the public opinion polling on this and continue to pursue it. And I think it will put the Republican senators who are up in 2016 in states that were won by Obama and that are either swing or blue states, I think it will put them in a delicate position politically. Anybody else want to respond to that, or we can move on to the next question? Arun, do you have anything to add?
I would just say that, you know, the issue of wages is so central to people's attitudes when they go to the polls. You know, I think that this election showed that there's an improving economy, but people aren't feeling that in terms of their own earnings. And people realize the long stagnation of wages in this country and how that's quite the opposite for folks who are the most well-off and for some of our largest corporations that are showing record profits. So that sense and that that's a source of anger, I think, for voters. And, you know, I think officials of both, elected officials of both parties need to heed that.
Yeah. And I think that's great. And I think this is Anna, and I think that's reflected in what both Aaron and I mentioned in terms of Republican candidates that had to flip their positions on the minimum wage. You saw that with Tom Cotton in Arkansas. We saw it with Dan Sullivan in Alaska. And in Illinois, Bruce Rayner, he actually had to reverse his position in the course of a day. And so we see how potent these play out in the races. And I think it serves as a warning for future Republican candidates who, you know, have to face these again.
Great. Thank you. Operator, do we have any other questions queued up?
Certainly. As a reminder, it is star one to ask a question, and we'll take our next question from Dave Jamieson with Huffington Post.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for doing the call. I wanted to ask about something that Arun touched on. You know, these progressive ballot initiatives obviously did really well. Democratic candidates, not so much. When it comes to the minimum wage, you know, that passed in Arkansas and Alaska with great numbers, but it doesn't seem to have saved Pryor or Begich. At this point, should Democrats not be thinking of minimum wage as something that's really going to help drive turnout when it's on there as a ballot initiative?
I'm happy to answer that. I think, actually, in my view, you know, Democrats should double down on it. It does drive turnout. You have some institutional barriers in the midterm election to try to overcome that, frankly, created political headwinds that maybe were too strong. But I just think, in terms of the attitudes of voters, and you see this in exit polling, and you see this in the surveys that that Tom Jensen reported on that took place in both an existing midterm competitive states and then in the battleground states for 2016, these issues are front and center in people's minds. And when you have a situation where people are called on to vote on a raise for themselves, it inevitably will drive turnout at a higher level than you would see otherwise. Obviously, we don't have the analysis yet, and I think as you see the analysis done about turnout in these states, my sense is you'll see that compared to other midterm elections in similar states and similar environments, you know, you had turnout that was actually significantly better. So it strikes me as something that politicians and elected officials, particularly on the Democratic side, should be embracing more so rather than less so as a result of this election.
I'd just like to add also, if you look at the numbers, you know, we see that in this year, we didn't have as good turnout, you know, in a midterm for minorities and for women. But not just that we didn't have as good turnout for 2012 than from 2012, but we're projected to have even higher numbers, you know, in 2016 in terms of the share of the electorate that will be minorities and women. And so I think, like, they're facing a huge headwind for 2016 on a lot of these issues. And also, if you see polling on the minimum wage, you see that African Americans overwhelmingly support raising the minimum wage. We saw a Quinnipiac poll at around 91%. Hispanics are around 74, women at 76. And so, again, I think the 2016 will be a very different landscape and a very different electorate.
Great, thank you. Operator, any other questions in the queue?
We'll take our next question from Sahil Kapoor with TPM.
Hi, thank you for doing this call. I wanted to ask to any of the participants on the call, when you look back over the last year, year and a half, are there any things you think that Democrats did wrong? Did the party, did the people who were running the midterm campaigns lead the party astray in any way? And are there things you would have done differently?
Hey, I mean, this is Brad Woodhouse. I'll take that first and see if anybody else wants to address it. I don't really think so. I mean, if you look at, look, Republicans have gotten, or at least patted themselves on the back for the type of people they nominated. You know that they were, you know, not the Aikens and the Murdochs, and that there might be some truth to that. I actually think if you look at some of their candidates, I think once they get, you know, they'll be in the Cruz caucus once they get to the Senate. Tillis will be, Ernst will be. So whatever the case is, but I think if you look at the people that were, you know, that were put up, particularly, let's say, the challenge races, really strong candidates in really tough races, whether it's Michelle Nunn in Georgia or Allison Grimes in Kentucky or Natalie Tennant in West Virginia. Look, if you look at the political committees on the Democratic side, the DCCC did a tremendous job in fundraising and putting all the resources together that they needed to try to hold the line on Republican gains. The DSCC, which I've always considered one of the best political committees in the history of politics, I think it did everything that they could. I think institutionally, what was brought to bear, organized labor, in these races, the efforts at turnout, I don't really think that there was anything left on the playing field or anything left in the playbook from the perspective of the mechanics of campaigns, turnout, ads, money. Now, I think there could be some arguments about how candidates, and I'm not going to get in to citing any individually, about how candidates, you know, position themselves vis-a-vis some of these issues or the president or whatever, whatever else. Look, the Republicans drew a really good hand here in terms of the environment, the six-term itch, the map, gerrymandering. They masqueraded as moderates late to say that they would try to compromise and govern, and supported some of the, you know, gave lip service to supporting some of the ballot initiatives, that we've mentioned here. And the other thing they did, quite frankly, was they made government look as dysfunctional as possible, and then they laid that at the feet of the governing party, which is the president. They did this through their obstruction. They did this through fear mongering, across the board on Ebola, ISIS, the border, you name it. They injected issues into this race to hurt the president, and everyone knows that the president's approval rating is tied to the outcome of midterm elections. So, I think all those things came to bear on the race. I don't think you can look back and say that Democrats should have raised more money, because I think we did a good job of that. That we should have done something different in terms of how we use data or turnout. It was just a really crappy environment for Democrats and a real crappy map. I don't know, Tom, do you have anything else to add to that from your perspective?
No, I think that pretty well covers it.
No. Okay. If no one else has anything to add to that, do we have any other questions?
And this concludes today's question and answer session. I'd like to turn it back to our speakers for any additional or closing remarks.
Great. Well, I want to thank everybody for getting on the call. I'm glad we kept this to right at 30 minutes. I will open up the floor if there's anything anybody in the speaking program would like to add. Hearing nothing, we'll close this call. I think that folks will get you a readout from this, and if you have any interest in talking to any of the speakers or have any additional questions, be in touch with Center for American Progress, which set up the call, and then I'm sure any of us would be glad to respond to any follow-up. So thanks, everybody, for doing the call, and we'll be in touch soon.
This concludes today's conference. We thank you for your participation.